All right. Now it's my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. Please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Tommy from Visalia.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Tommy, and I'm an alcoholic. For those of you who don't know me, you can probably gather from my accent that I'm not from this area. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and I know I'm amongst a lot of Giant fans in this area, but I got to admit I'm a Dodger fan. There's about four of us here. I was raised out on Long Island.
Long Island, yeah.
I'm looking for somebody out there, and I just don't see her tonight. So, my sponsor and my wife, both, I'm sure there's other people too, they tell me that there's times when I talk too loud. Part of that reason is growing up in New York, and specifically Brooklyn, is that when you're in the subway stations, they're pretty loud, and when you want to talk to somebody, you have to talk loud. The same thing with out in the streets with the taxi cabs and everything else honking their horns. And a New Yorker himself is just, that's the way you're born, you talk loud. And I've been away from New York for 40 years. A lot of the attitudes that I brought with me from New York, I've left. I've left them behind, with the exception of my accent and occasionally talking loud. I guess I'll start in the beginning. That would be a good place to start. My early childhood consisted of a mother and a father, and you know, really it was a good childhood with one exception. I did lose my mother at about 14 years old. I was 14. She was only 47. I lost her to cancer. I, honest to God, don't remember if she drank, but I do know she smoked cigarettes. My dad then was left with the responsibility of raising myself and my younger sister. And years later, he told me that he felt he was on the verge of alcoholism. Whatever that is, I don't know. But because he knew he had responsibility to his children and to also trying to keep the house, which was bought after World War II, that he would have to stop drinking and work two or three jobs for as long as he could to keep everybody together, which he did. And 20 years, for the last 20 years of his life, he didn't drink, and he died sober. He was, and still is in my mind and in my heart, the finest man I ever saw. I ever met. He taught me a lot of things about life, about how to treat other people, about sports, so many good, positive things I learned from him. But as you're going to hear from me, I completely forgot about them, lost them, thank God not forever, at least I hope not, when I started drinking. Father's Day just passed, and Father's Day in my life had a lot of positive and some negative things. I'll go back to Father's Day of 1964. Yeah. There aren't many, I'm looking at the faces here, that were around on Father's Day of 1964. But several positive things happened to me on that Sunday. I graduated from high school. I was 17 years old. And with regard to sports, a pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies, Jim Bunning, pitched a perfect game that day, which doesn't happen too often in baseball, against the New York Mets. Bunning went on to have a long career as a state senator, as a U.S. senator from Kentucky. The negative things that happened to me on that day, I drank alcohol for the first time in my life. I got drunk for the first time in my life. And I threw up from alcohol for the first time in my life. And the next day I had my first hangover. As I go into my share, you'll see why Father's Day played a very, very important part in my life later on. But that Father's Day of 1964 started a 42-year journey for me of drinking. My life with alcohol didn't cause me any tremendous problems. I mean, I only had one job my whole life, so I never lost my job, a job due to drinking. Never got a DUI, though you must understand that back in the 60s there was no DUI, and I was stopped quite a few times by cops for driving under the influence. But they just took your keys then and said, you know, when you sober up, we'll give you back your keys. That was the extent of it. I've been married to the same woman for a long time. To the same saintly woman for a long, long time. And she is a normie. I started working, as I said, when I was 18, on Long Island. I worked for a company, maybe some of you have heard of them. If not, you've heard of some of the products that they developed. It was called Grumman. They were a defense contractor. We built the lunar module. That's the funny-looking thing that landed the men on the moon back in 1969. We also built the F-14 fighter aircraft for the Navy, which was depicted and made famous in the Tom Cruise movie Top Gun. We built a lot of aircraft for the Navy. I was a functioning alcoholic. And to prove that point is that I never missed a day of work due to my drinking. Showed up many a time with hangovers, but never showed up for work late. Spent an awful lot of money on breath mints, breath spray, Visine, stuff like that over the years. And I'm telling you, I don't care how many times I would brush my teeth before I went to work and then goggled, but that taste was still in my mouth, and it stayed there most of the day. And then somebody told me once that, because I was drinking gin at the time, said if you drink vodka, they can't smell it on your breath. And I also found out it was cheaper than gin. So I switched over for vodka, and that was my drink of choice for a lot of years. But I still got that taste lingering in my mouth all day long. The company moved me and my family throughout the United States about 4 or 5 different times. And that's why I'm saying that I was a functioning alcoholic. I guess I did a pretty darn good job for them, because to up and move a family, your household goods and everything else, is kind of expensive. And that was my first move out here to California back in 1975. We had a plant in Corcoran. I moved several times since then, and my drinking never, ever increased the amount. It says in the book, a book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it doesn't depend on the number of drinks, how much you drink, or how long you drink. It's what alcohol does to you. Now, this may sound very, very silly to you, But I never, ever, with rare exceptions, if somebody was getting married or something like that, I never drank before 5 o'clock in the evening. Because you have cocktails at 5. So you're not a drunk. You're not an alcoholic if you have your cocktails. And as my drinking progressed, I would sit there in the kitchen. The clock is up like that. And I would have my bottle of vodka. I'd have my vermouth, which I would only use for the first drink. I normally ended up throwing that bottle of vermouth out after a couple of months because it turned. I'd even have my olives sitting there. And I would watch the clock. And as 5 o'clock came, then I knew it was okay for me to drink. I was not an alcoholic. And this kept me, in my own mind, going for quite a few years of drinking. My health, I guess it held up all right. I'm learning now as I get older that certain things were happening to me that I didn't realize at the time. At 50 years of age, I retired. And I said to my wife that I wanted to stay home and be Mr. Mom to my 2 daughters, who at that time were roughly maybe 6 and 13, 14 years old, something like that. And she said, fine. What a deal for her. She'll go out and get a job, and I'll stay home and take care of the girls. The drinking obviously continued, but never, ever changed from the 5 o'clock in the evening. Never. When I retired, I would have to say that the last 10 or 12 years of my drinking were definitely the worst part of my life. You see, when I first started drinking, my attitude and approach to life was the glass is always half full. I was a very, very optimistic individual. I was also a happy guy. When there were parties, they always wanted me there because I wasn't belligerent. I wouldn't start fights. I would just be the center of the party. It was a good time, and I enjoyed it. And that continued on for a lot of years. And then the last 12 years of my drinking is when, and now as I look back on it, I can see what they were talking about when they say the progressiveness of this disease. Because I turned into a very mean, angry, and lonely person. My wife would say to me every once in a while, "Why? What happened to you? Why did you change to what you are now?" And I really had no answer for it. I wasn't going to blame it on the alcohol, because that would be admitting that I had a problem drinking, and if I wanted to go back to my old way of being a happy-go-lucky guy, that means I'd have to quit drinking. And what am I going to do with my life without alcohol? So I didn't care. I didn't. Life went on where all day long, and you got to understand, I stuck to that 5 o'clock rule up to the day I stopped drinking. I stuck to the 5 o'clock rule. I'd sit there during the day, and how many hours do I have to go? It's 12 noon. I got 5 hours to go. How am I going to last? But then 5 o'clock always came, and I was fine then. I'm getting now back to, well, let me back up a little bit. The relationship with my 2 daughters, I guess, at best I can say that I really wasn't there for them when they needed me for important things. Important things like sitting down and talking to your father about boys. I mean, not boys in the you know, you know what the sense I'm talking about. I'm just talking about, you know, well, what if we go out to the movies tonight or this or stuff like that. But I wasn't there. I wasn't there to give them my advice because it was, no, you're going to do it this way or go talk to your mother. Don't bother me. And this was in the important developing stages of their life. But my wife, that's a different subject. I never hit her. I never, ever struck her. Because she said to me during the years, those last 10 or 12 years, she said, if you ever hit me, I'm out the door. And she was smart also, because then we were living back in California, and they have that 50-50 rule. So she says, 50% of everything you got is mine, if you ever hit me. And she said that, has said that to me since I've got sober too, that that was the God's honest truth. Now that 50-50 rule still stands, so that doesn't change. But as you'll see, I changed. But you know, occasionally I read in the newspaper about some celebrity or some sports figure that verbal or nonverbal abuse to his girlfriend or to his wife. And that was my forte those last few years. I would sit there in the evening after I had my first or second one, and I would think to myself, you know, I haven't had a fight with her in a while. What is a while? A couple of days or a week? I need to start a fight. I just freaking need to do that. And I don't know why, but that was the way I was living and thinking. And I would start a fight. Dinner's supposed to be at 6:15, at 6:16, where's my dinner? No excuse was good, and there was the fight. Then I would go a couple of days without even recognizing her, without even talking to her. And the only time that I would make up with her was when I needed something. And it was normally something in the bedroom. But that's the way my mind was thinking. So that's the way it was. The way it was. What happened? Again, I get back to, now it's a week before Father's Day of 2007. And I had battles with, I learned when I got sober that it was probably pancreatitis, which if any of you don't know about that, 99% of the time it's caused by excessive alcohol use over a period of a lot of years. And this one night, and you know, the times that you go to the emergency room, it always seems like it's in the middle of the night, 2:00 in the morning. That's the time you always get sick enough that you have to go to the emergency room. And that's what happened to me. And they took me in, and the doctors diagnosed it immediately as pancreatitis. The only immediate cure for pancreatitis is morphine. And I never ever did drugs. Growing up in the 50s and the 60s, drugs, yeah, out in Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, they were a big thing. But in the East Coast, it really wasn't a big thing. And sports was so important in my life, I didn't want to put something like that into my body. But they told me morphine and a liquid diet. Give the pancreas rest, and also the morphine will kill the pain. And after a couple of days, I'm feeling fine, and they let me go home a Thursday. And I go back to my normal routine of drinking. Even though they had sat there in my room, two separate doctors, and told me, if you continue drinking, you're going to die. I'm 60 years old at this point. I'm not 30 where I can say, you know, hey, no big deal, I'm immortal, I'm going to live forever, I'm not going to worry about some disease that I can't even pronounce. I'm 60 and I want to live. But I go back to my drinking when they let me out of the hospital. Father's Day comes, family's there and everything else. I had my normal drinking and everything else, and I go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, the same freaking pain. And I know it this time. And I'm walking around the bedroom, didn't wake my wife up, and I make a deal. I make a deal with God. I don't want to quit drinking. But I said, God, if you take the pain away from me right now, because I didn't want to be embarrassed going back to the emergency room and seeing the same nurses, possibly, the same doctors who had told me only a couple of days before, quit drinking. I didn't want to be embarrassed. So I'm walking around the bedroom and I said, God, you take away the pain and I'll call a friend of mine. Some of you guys know him, SpongeBob, who I've known for 40 years. We used to drink together. Not that often, but we did drink together. Who was sober at that point. I said, I'll call him the next morning and just talk to him. Within a minute, the pain went away. And I went back to bed. When I woke up the next morning, I remembered that I had to fulfill my promise to God. So I call his house about 8 o'clock in the morning. He's at the Alano Club at a meeting. I get his wife. And I don't want to tell her I want to speak to her husband about booze. So I say, I got a problem with my sprinkler system. You see, Bob is handy. I say, will you have him come on over? So Bob comes home from the meeting. He calls me up. He says, what the hell are you talking about sprinkler system? I says, Bob, I need to talk to you. He says, I'll be right there. And we talked for several hours. And he said to me, he says, can you go without a drink today? I said, if you pick me up before 5 o'clock, I guarantee you I won't have a drink. But if you come after 5 o'clock, I can't guarantee anything. So he comes to me at about 4:30, takes me over to the Alano Club for a meeting there. There's a woman behind the bar. She's talking to Bob about me, saying maybe he ought to go to rehab. He looks like he's in bad shape. I overhear this, and I get pissed. And I say to Bob, get me the hell out of here. I'm not going to stay here. Now, the ironic thing about that is that for 7.5 out of my 8 years sober, you can find me at the Alano Club every single Saturday morning, either as the secretary or as the treasurer. So that club that I walked out of that first night, I've been going to for years and being of service with that club. He takes me to the men's stag meeting in the old location across the street from Checkers. And I walk downstairs, that's where it was held at that time, and there's a whole bunch of men. And I'm a regular at the gym, Lifestyles. And for a month or so before this night, I'm walking the track and I see this old guy walking the track. He's pulling an oxygen tank. And I think, geez, I feel sorry for this guy. So I try to talk to him, and he's hard of hearing, and I'm feeling sorry. So I maybe walk one or two times around the track, and he'd get tired, and he'd go home. Well, don't you know, as I walk downstairs, there is that guy sitting at that meeting. And his name is Tommy. Is God not working, trying to help me to stay sober, to get sober? The next day, I'm at the gym, and I see him over on one of the bicycles, and I'm on the track, and I'm waving away to him, and he doesn't wave back to me. And I feel like, oh, man, everything I wanted, it's not going to happen. What's wrong? Then I go over closer to him, and I said, Tommy, I've been waving to you. He's freaking near blind. He couldn't see me. I said, I want you to please be my sponsor. He says, no problem. And I know there's different types of sponsors. in AA, and I guess it falls into two types of categories, at least it did for me, from what I have heard. One is what they refer to as the Nazis, that you got to do it this way, and that's fine. But then there's the other type that coddles you. At 60 years of age, I needed coddling. I didn't need somebody yelling and screaming at me. I really, really didn't. I needed a guy like this Tommy. He lived for 2 more years and he got me on the right road to sobriety. Being of service, I was only sober maybe the first year. And, we have the Christmas parade. Well, I go to the Monday night, and it's always Monday night, and I go to my meeting, and I can't find a freaking parking space. So I go home. So next day, because every week I would see Tommy on a Tuesday afternoon at his place, and he says, "Where were you last night?" I said, "What the hell do you mean? A guy drove around for 15 minutes and couldn't find a parking space. I went home." I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I was at the meeting." I said, "What?" And he says to me, "If you were looking for a bottle of booze, you would have found the place, wouldn't you have?" I says, "Yeah." He used to have Dial-A-Ride take him to the meeting. Well, Dial-A-Ride couldn't get down that street. They dropped him off at Redwood, and he freaking walked all the way down to the meeting. That taught me a lesson right there that, if you'll find a meeting when you need to find a meeting. There's things like that that I'll forever be grateful to him. He dies. I knew at that point that I needed to do what I had been doing the previous 2 months, so immediately I went out and got another sponsor. And all I said to him was, I said, "I'd like to follow the same routine that Tommy and I had." And that was, we meet once a week for an hour, that's it. At his convenience, I'm retired, he's working, whenever, I don't care. And we have no format. Maybe we just talk all that hour about what happened the previous week, or about sports, or about or we get into the book. But it's just where I know that there's somebody there when I need that person. And I guess it was about 4 years later, my, at that time, 31-year-old daughter admitted that she had a real, real bad problem with alcoholism, and that her liver was, at 31, was in pretty bad shape. And she lives up in Sacramento. I didn't know what the hell to do. But I relied on my sponsor, and I relied on the other people in AA to help me. People offered to drive me up to Sacramento. Most of them offered to say prayers for me and my daughter. And she's coming up on 4 years of sobriety. So don't tell me. When I used to go to meetings and people would brag about having family members in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd sit there and think, "You gotta be kidding. Why would you brag about another drunk in the family?" I know why they brag now. I got a loved one, my daughter, in AA. So I get back to Father's Day. So the Father's Day of 1964, I had my first drink, and with the help of God, Father's Day of 2007, I hope to God I have my last drink. Father's Day is very, very important to me. No. My sobriety date is the next day. That's the first day that I went a full day past 5 o'clock without drinking. What helped me in the beginning? For anybody that's brand new or fairly new, the book Living Sober, yellow cover book, that was a tremendous help to me. All of this is a compilation of different ideas, different facts that actually worked of alcoholics in the beginning. And what they did, if you feel tired, well, lay down, take a nap. If you're hungry, have something to eat. I took one particular room in our house because the one daughter had moved out. I said to my wife, I'm going to turn that into a sports memorabilia room. She says, go ahead, do whatever you want to do. Just don't drink. So I turned it into my man cave, and it's got sports memorabilia all over the place. But it kept my mind off drinking for a week or so. That's the key. Now, you know, Bill W. was hit with that epiphany immediately, and the desire to drink was lifted immediately from him. But Dr. Bob, who was played so beautifully in the movie My Name is Bill W. by James Garner, Dr. Bob, he went a couple of years with the desire still there. I was a lot like Dr. Bob. It was, I don't know when it was, but I can tell you, it took a while. It took a year or two. But all of a sudden, one day I woke up and I realized that I hadn't been thinking about drinking for quite a long time. And since then, the obsession to drink is not there. What I have to work on now is trying to live a better life every single day. That's what I want so desperately to work on. And how do I do it? I go to meetings. Now, in the beginning, they said go to 90 and 90, and I did that. And I did that, and what I got out of it was I found the meetings that I felt the most comfortable at. And I found them. Now I go to 4 meetings every single week. I go to those same meetings, and I don't miss them. I don't, unless I'm out of town. I do not miss them. I read a little bit every single morning. I love to read the promises in the big book, and I love to read On Awakening. It just gets me, you know, 5 minutes after I read those freaking pages, I forget probably most times what the heck was in there. But every once in a while, it stays with me. And that helps me for that particular day. Something else may help me, but that helps me on particular days. I stay in contact. I see, there's a couple of my friends here that I see at the gym every single day. I see people at in the mall, at stores. And I still get the nice feeling when I see another alcoholic outside the environment of the meetings and stuff like that. It just gives me a good feeling to know that this person is there, and I hope to God still doing well. I think the most important, they're all important, but doing the steps, of course. I'm going through it a second time now. But being of service, that was another thing that Tommy said to me. He says, you got to get a balance in your life, a balance between Alcoholics Anonymous and your outside life. I says, what the hell are you talking about? He says, you got to try to be of service. So I saw in AA, that's no problem. From being a secretary or a treasurer to greeting a newcomer as he walks in the door, or she, or greeting somebody that you know is going, you know the person very well, but they're going through a tough time, and just putting out your hand and shaking that other person's hand or giving that person a hug, that's being of service. It's helping you and it's helping that other person. Also being of service outside of AA. And that's where I think it's really helped me, and I passed that on to a couple of other guys and one girl in AA. We joined the Hospital Guild over at Kauai Delta. You know, all you got to do is put in 48 hours in 1 year. That's it, to stay an active member. But it takes yourself, and it takes the self-centeredness out of you for that particular 3 hours that you're working. Now, where do I work? I work in discharge. And why do I work there? Because everybody's happy. They're going home. Some of the people, they work in dialysis. Some work in the ICU. That's That's nice, and I applaud them. But for me, I like to be happy. I was sad and lonely for too long. So now I want to surround myself with positive people. I have gone back to the way I was before the alcohol really took its hold on me. I'm back to a guy that was, the glass is half full. I don't like negativity. I want to be a positive, happy person. The only way for me to do that is continue in Alcoholics Anonymous and continue doing everything I've done for the past 8 years. A couple other guys are going to get a kick out of this, but John Roberts, who is the Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court, a couple of years ago, there was a court case brought before the Supreme Court, a very important one, and I'm not going to mention what it was, but it was a tie, the first initial vote, 4-4, and he was the one that was going to break the tie, either way, and he broke the tie, and 5-4, and it went on, and he was asked after that by his critics and his supporters why he had voted the way he voted. And they were looking for a long, legal, lawyer, attorney-like answer. And his answer was plain and simple. He said it was the right thing to do. For so many years, I was doing the wrong things. Now I'm trying my darndest to do the right things. And again, Bill W. came through and helped me. He put in the big book. He says, progress, not perfection. And I'm making a little bit of progress every single day. Maybe I'll fall back one day and pick it up the next day. But when it comes to making a decision now with regard to relationships, with family, with friends, with anything, I try to look at the right way, the right decision to make at that particular time, and take myself out of the picture, if I possibly can. I want to thank all of you very, very much for inviting me here tonight. Bill, thank you. It's a pleasure to see so many people that I know, and now I know a heck of a lot more. Thank you very, very much.
All right. The Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. So we invite you to come early and stay after the meeting to get better acquainted.